I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Rachel Kahn. She's Interim Executive Director of Amigos Bravos. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's been a long time since, it's been a while at least since we've had you guys on the air. A very important, perhaps a little bit low-profile organization here in New Mexico. What do you guys do?
We are a statewide water protection organization. We work to protect and restore the waters of New Mexico. We've been around for 27 years, and we are a small but feisty group of advocates that work to protect all the waters in New Mexico, our rivers and streams, as well as our groundwater.
Which is a big, huge job.
Yes, it is. There are a lot of threats and impacts to our waters here in New Mexico, and we work on many fronts to address those impacts.
Let's talk about some of those impacts and some of the ways in which you're working. I mean, one way is water contamination.
Yes, so we have three main project areas. We work to restore watershed health, hold polluters accountable, and build a river protection movement for the future. And so the holding polluters accountable is where we really focus on narrowing in on the bigger polluters in the state. And we try to use all the tools at our disposal to address those impacts from those polluters. So we use laws and regulations. We use stakeholder processes and conversations. But we're not afraid to sue people, too. We have done that as well.
So, yeah.
And we use the Clean Water Act, which is a federal tool, a federal law that has very strong avenues for citizen participation for protecting our rivers and streams.
It goes to show organizations like yours, I think, that a law or a set of rules is only as good as the enforcement. And sometimes that enforcement doesn't come from the people who are supposed to enforce it, but rather from nonprofit groups or citizens.
Definitely. I mean, sometimes it's a lack of resources on the part of the regulators, and sometimes it's the lack of political will. But you're right. In many cases, there's not enforcement. There's not the oversight that we need to protect our rivers. And that's where groups like Amigos Bravos are key for holding polluters accountable, for protecting our waters, which is one of the most important resources we have here in the state.
You have some initiatives, and one of them is a wetlands initiative on the Rio Grande. Talk about that.
So we are excited by this new project. We have been working with GIS consultants and with our partners with Western Environmental Law Center to identify wetland gems in the headwaters of the Rio Grande. And what those are wetlands that we've done some prioritization and some mapping around identifying wetlands that are important for providing stream flow and resiliency in the face of climate change. And so these are wetlands that contribute, are highly functioning and contributing stream flow. They're spring fed, they're providing cold water. So all these categories of the way wetlands are categorized, we searched for wetlands. We did a GIS mapping project where we identified 8 priority wetland systems that we are calling the Rio Grande Headwater Wetland Gems. And we are now advocating for, we have maps and you can view them on our website, and we are now advocating for special protections of those wetlands in the Carson National Forest plan update, as well as other planning processes like the Taos Regional Water Plan, and advocating for restoration priority.
Are they all on public land?
The ones, yes, these initial ones, these headwater, I mean, many of the headwaters in the state of a lot of our stream systems are on Forest Service land, and these are all in the Carson National Forest. And they're critically important. Wetlands are, I mean, they're spectacularly beautiful. We were just up there this past weekend in a restoration project up in one of the wetland gems, and they are... They're the sponges of our watersheds. What happens is when you have a healthy functioning wetland, when the snow melts or the rain falls, they soak up all the water like a sponge, and then they slowly release that water into our streams over time. And when you have degraded wetlands, they dry up and they're no longer functioning, what you get is all that snow melt and that rain water just flows down all at once in the spring runoff and flows down south. And what we get is drying up streams later in the season. So they're critically important, especially in the face of climate change, that we have highly functioning wetlands. They're like reservoirs where you don't need to go to the state engineer to get a permit to have them.
Well, and that's one of the things that is sort of counterintuitive to many of us who have kind of an industrial mentality, which is, how do you store something? You dig a tank and store it in there. Well, actually, the best way to store water is in healthy soil.
Yes, yeah, and in the plants and the soils that make up these wet meadows and wetlands that are scattered across our whole headwaters. Unfortunately, a lot of them are getting degraded, and they're losing their functionality. And what's happening is the dryland species and the trees and the woody shrubs are starting to encroach. We're getting head cuts are creating ditches in these wetlands, and so they drain quickly. You get an incised channel, and all the water drains out, and all the wetland plants and the soils die, and then they lose their capacity to hold water.
How does that happen?
Well, you get some of the larger impacts to wetlands are roads and poor land management and grazing management. Cows and their hooves action on the sensitive soils of wetlands can have a huge impact on the hooves. You can break apart banks. You can create head cuts with grazing.
What are head cuts?
Head cuts are when you get chunks of soil that are breaking off, and it's starting to create like a mini arroyo. And it moves up, so the head of it keeps on falling down, creating a longer channel, a longer arroyo. It moves up gradient. So basically creates an incised channel that drains away the water.
So when you do a restoration project, what do? You fill those in?
You can, yes. There's a number of different techniques right now. The one we were just at one of our wetland gems this past weekend, Amigos Bravos, with our partners with the Albuquerque Wildlife Federation and the Carson National Forest. And we were at 10,000 feet, and we got 38 volunteers to make it all the way up there. It was quite a drive. Many of them came from Albuquerque. And so we were working on a riparian fence. Is one way is to keep the cows away from the channel, the riparian channel and the wetlands that are immediately adjacent to the riparian area. And then for places where you have the damage like head cuts and stream bank cuts, there's various different techniques you can use. One is called a Zuni bowl, which is a rocks that you make in kind of a round bowl-like shape at the bottom, right where the head cut, the top of the head cut. And so when the water is flowing and falling off of the edge of the head cut and falling into the deeper channel that's been created, it dissipates the energy of that water.
So instead of flowing, it goes into the bowl and then soaks into the ground?
Yes. Yeah, and the sediment drops out, and so ultimately you start building back up the sediment that the channel, so that you're starting to fill in the channel.
Have you done some of these restorations over time and seen the sort of before and after kind of difference?
Yeah, so the project we were just working on this weekend, we originally had done some work back in 2007 with some of the same volunteers, which was really exciting to see some of the same folks that some I hadn't seen since that project, so, 8 years ago. And so we had initially put in one riparian exclosure, and within that exclosure we saw the stream banks really recover and the grasses are really taking off inside that exclosure.
We're talking to Rachel Kahn of Amigos Bravos. I love that the techniques for restoring wetlands and so much of this work is really low tech. Mm. It's like moving rocks.
Yeah, I mean, we have one rock dams. That's a line of rocks, just one deep.
Right.
That slows down the water, drops out the sediment, and starts to build up channels. So, yeah, it's very low tech. Fence building can be hard work, but really, it's pretty low tech as well. And fencing off critical areas is also very effective.
You're also doing some work with respect to the EPA Clean Water Act.
Yes, this is the Clean Water Act is a fundamental part of our work at Amigos Bravos. So most aspects of our work touch on the Clean Water Act. And what happened in 2001 is the Supreme Court came out with a ruling that really impacted the way the Clean Water Act was applied across the nation, but it, particularly here in New Mexico, because we're such an arid state and so many of our waters here don't flow year-round. So they are, the technical terms are ephemeral and intermittent waterways, and that we have 93% of our waters are ephemeral or intermittent. And this Supreme Court ruling in 2001 and then another one in 2006 called into question whether those ephemeral and intermittent waters are protected under the Clean Water Act. And we've been working since then to advocate for them to have the protections restored. They had been they had been protected from 1974 until 2001. And then it was called into question and things started to fall through the holes.
Oh my goodness, these are the kind of things you never think of. Like, if a river flows part-time, is it not really a river, like, worthy of protection?
Yes, exactly. And yeah, that's what was that question for, and people have been fighting over, and it's become this really big
who's on the other
deal.
Side
well there's there's a lot of different there's a lot of untruths out there, so people have been scared, so people have been told, oh, if this, so after all this was happening, the loss of protections, there was this the EPA developed this rule, a clean water rule, which restored some of the protections that had been lost, but not all of them, just some of them. And that's the rule that was finally finalized by the EPA last month. And the other side, the people against this rule and against these protections, have been saying, oh, this is a big power grab by the EPA. They're trying to regulate the puddles in your driveway. You won't be able to do anything. And it's, you know, like a police state taking away your freedoms. That's the kind of rhetoric that has been put out there. So
right,
there's been a lot of fear generated, and it was used as a tool to get people out to vote in numerous elections over since the last decade. So
right,
there were concerns that there would be impacts on agriculture, but in fact, there are all the historic exemptions for agriculture will exist in the Clean Water Act under this rule, and they even identify in this clean water rule that EPA just passed new practices that if farmers use, they'll get additional exemptions. So they're best management practices that if you do these certain practices in your farming techniques, you'll have even more exemptions under the Clean Water Act than you have historically had. And there's lots of activities that are sometimes, you know, I think it's a shame how many are exempt because there are impacts to water quality. But those will continue to exist under this new rule. But there was a lot of fear-mongering around this rule, and a lot of people came out against it.
One would think that, I mean, if you look at the really big picture, it is it not in the interest of agriculture to have a healthy river system?
Definitely, to have clean water to irrigate your fields. And there were a lot of farmers, usually smaller farmers, that came out in support of the rule. So there was a big movement of sustainable agricultural interests in support of this clean water rule. And the fight isn't over, and that's why it's really important here in New Mexico that we encourage our elected officials. Right now, the Senate will have an opportunity to, or will be pressured, members of Senate, to stop this rule. And our representatives Lujan and Lujan Grisham in the northern part of the state, there was a vote up right before the EPA finalized the bill to stop the implementation of the rule. And our two representatives here in northern New Mexico voted for clean water. They voted against the bill, which would have stopped the rule. So
and won?
No, they didn't. That's why now it goes to the Senate, why it's critical. It's critical that we, you know, the House of Representatives right now is difficult for progressive environmental causes.
Right.
And so now the Senate will be voting on that same bill, and that's why we need to continue to request that our senators here in New Mexico protect clean water.
And ladies and gentlemen, in Radio Land, if you are interested in finding out more about this, you can go to amigosbravos.org, and there you will be directed on whom to call and but I mean, who, like, what parties have an interest in dirty water in New Mexico or in not having rules? Like, who are we talking about?
Well, our state environment department wrote comments against this rule. So we have even our state agency that is tasked with protecting our resources, protecting our waters here in New Mexico, came out against supporting this rule. This
but
is
why?
In stark contrast. Well, there's a lot of business interests. There's fear that this will result in more permit requirements or more requirements on industry to keep pollution out of water, which is expensive. And so there's economic interests.
So it's basically economic interests that want to have the freedom to dirty the waters.
Not be required to clean the waters, which is expensive. Yes.
Okay.
So, and unfortunately, we have a state agency that is not protecting our interests. I mean, they came out against the rule in their comments, and we're seeing that again and again these days with our state environment department not taking their responsibility seriously to protect our natural resources, to protect water quality in the state of New Mexico.
Which makes citizen groups like this all the more important in these times.
Yeah, I mean, we've been around for 27 years, and we started with our work on Chevron Molycorp Mine up in Cuesta. That was the initial work that Amigos Bravos formed around, and we have since expanded to a statewide organization. We have over 2,000 members, and we really depend on our members. We really depend on our supporters. We have lots and lots of volunteers, and feel very supported by a lot of members of the public in New Mexico.
Now, there's another set of initiatives having to do with stormwater discharges at Los Alamos National Laboratory. First of all, what is stormwater?
Stormwater is the water that flows, we all have seen it, when it rains and you're in a parking lot, a lot of that water flows off. It doesn't sink into the cement, into the impervious surface, as it's called, impervious surfaces.
Yeah, there's a lot of it on Cerrillos Road when you're driving during a rainstorm.
Yes, and that water, as it's flowing, sheet flow across the cement, it picks up contaminants. It picks up heavy metals, it picks up hydrocarbons, it picks up all sorts of things, even sediment, even if it's flowing on fields that don't have healthy plant growth. It can pick up a lot of sediment and cause erosion. And all of those things ultimately end up into our rivers. And so stormwater can be very problematic for water quality across the state. And what we've been working to do in Los Alamos is to make sure that when it rains up in Los Alamos, that those discharges are cleaned and measures are taken to slow down that stormwater before it can flow for too long and pick up more contaminants.
Why Los Alamos in particular?
Well, we were, I guess we can go back to the beginning of why Amigos Bravos got involved. We have a strategic planning process in our organization where we bring in over 40 different stakeholders. Every 5 years, we bring them all to Ghost Ranch, and we talk about what community members, what different experts in different fields around water in the state of New Mexico. They all come to this retreat that we have, and we talk about where everyone thinks that we could have the most impact, where Amigos Bravos could have the most impact. And that really directs our work over the next 4 to 5 years of our new strategic plan, is based on the input of those stakeholders at that strategic planning session. And in the, I think it was 2004, it may have been 2003, it was the 2003-2004 process that we went through. Really, at that strategic planning retreat, we heard loud and clear from the people who were there that there was a lot of concern about water quality coming off of Los Alamos. And so that's really one of the main reasons that we turned our attention to Los Alamos. And we felt that the tools that we had developed with addressing contamination issues at the Chevron Molycorp Mine in Cuesta easily translated to work that we could do to look at the impacts at Los Alamos.
So what did you find? I mean, when you tested that stormwater, Is it any more contaminated than any other stormwater in the state?
Well, there are sites of where stormwater at Los Alamos have been measured at 40,000 times over the PCB levels in the stormwater have been measured at 40,000 times over the water quality standard that's protective of human health.
Good heavens.
So, yes. And that's, you know, and there's...
And PCBs are super carcinogenic.
Yeah, they're
very
toxic.
I grew up next to the Hudson River, and our drinking water was full of them.
Yeah. Yeah. They're very toxic. And there's other parameters. There's other things in that stormwater. There's heavy metals. And there's gross alpha. There's a lot of different things that we focused our attention on. And we saw that during storm events, a lot of that historic waste that had been dumped up there back, you know, for decades, back when there weren't too many regulations about how waste was disposed of, was mobilized when it rained. So when it rained, the rainwater would flow across the land, pick up these contaminants, and it would all flow down to the canyons on the Pajarito Plateau and ultimately into the Rio Grande and then ultimately into the drinking water source of the communities of Santa Fe and Albuquerque. So,
was there testing upstream and downstream of Los Alamos to see the differences, if there were differences in the drinking water quality?
So yes, there's been a lot of testing. It is actually very difficult to get during a storm event right below where the Los Alamos canyons come in. There's access issues. It's a lot of tribal land. And then there's just access issues because it's difficult terrain to get in. So to capture the stormwater plug in the Rio Grande itself is very difficult. So a lot of the attention has been focused on monitoring the flow in the canyons on the Pajarito Plateau and the water quality, as well as the now that monitoring's been set up, and we've gotten a stormwater permit in place for over 400 toxic sites. So the victory of that process that we've, the work that we've been doing for a decade now, is that we used the Clean Water Act. We had a Clean Water Act citizens lawsuit against the lab for violations of the Water Quality Act regarding stormwater discharges. And we got one of the most protective permits in place to control those stormwater discharges at 400 sites. That's controlling stormwater discharges from 400 sites around the lab. And
the lab had to put those in place.
They had to put controls in place. They have to put mechanisms for capturing that stormwater, settling out the contaminants.
And who monitors them to see if those controls are working properly?
So another part of the victory of our Clean Water Act lawsuit and this permit appeal process we went through is that we were able to obtain funding for this coalition of community groups called Communities for Clean Water. Amigos Bravos is a member of that. And that group has, through those settlement funds, been able to hire technical experts to monitor the implementation of those permits. So there is citizen oversight, but the regulatory agency is the EPA.
Very interesting. This is what I'm talking about. It's very important work that most people don't even know is going on in New Mexico that's protecting New Mexicans.
Yeah, there's a lot of kind of wonky policy issues that have a really big impact.
Yeah.
They seem kind of dry to some. Though I love all the kind of policy, dorky, wonky stuff. That's where I get excited and feel like I can make a difference. But it really does have a big impact on the ground. You know, once these policies get set, once, you know, like, where does the Clean Water Act apply in New Mexico? If you have a stream that, you know, doesn't fall under the jurisdiction of the Federal Clean Water Act, there are a lot of protections that fall out of place. You know, it's kind of like a whole focus shifts away from those waters and they're kind of left high and dry.
Yeah.
So that's why we really depend on citizen involvement in our work and support of our work. Right now we're having our largest fundraiser of the year. We have a raffle.
Yes, that's tomorrow, Thursday, up at Kate House in Taos.
Yes, yes. So we do this every year. It's our 20th annual raffle. And you get to, if you buy a ticket and you win, you can choose which prize. We have three grand prizes, and the winner gets to choose which of those grand prizes they want.
Nice.
You can either go to Peru for 7 days. To the Sacred Valley of the Incas, or you can win an acre of land in northern New Mexico.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Or you can choose the cash option, which is $3,000 cash.
I don't know what to choose.
I know which one. Yeah, it's a hard decision.
We are talking to Rachel Kahn of Amigos Bravos. Well, there's one more thing that we wanted to talk about, and that is the Valle de Oro National Wildlife Refuge.
Yeah, so that's a newer project Amigos Bravos has been working on. We are working on this is a new urban wildlife refuge in the South Valley of Albuquerque, and it's really a spectacular piece of land right on the Rio Grande. And we have been working with partners to monitor water quality down there. And so we have got an EPA Urban Waters grant, and we have partners with Talking Talons Youth Leadership and the Bosque Ecosystem Monitoring Project, as well as with the refuge, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service itself. We're also working with a group called Earth Force. So there's a lot of great partners that have come together. We're working with youth, training them how to use water quality monitoring equipment and teaching them about water quality and impacts to water quality, and gathering samples with them. And then we have a community monitoring team where we go out and we take samples with, you know, broader members of the South Valley community. And we do that both on set dates, but we also have this quick response process where we go out and we take stormwater samples. So if it's raining in the middle of the night, our coordinator down there gets up. Yes, gets up and gets out there and grabs a sample, because as I was mentioning before, when it's raining is when a lot of the contaminants are moving, and where we're taking the samples in the Valle del Oro wildlife refuges, many of the samples are taken in those drains and ditches that flow through the refuge that really, really flow quite strongly when it rains. It's draining a lot of the city.
Now, there's something really valuable about an urban wildlife refuge, because just for the sake of the people who are living around it, it's so important to remember that we share the land with all kinds of other species, both plant and animal.
Yeah, it's really exciting that this was set aside as a wildlife refuge. It's the first urban wildlife refuge in the Southwest, and it's in a community that doesn't have many open spaces that aren't filled with industry. The South Valley is very heavily impacted by all sorts of industry, all sorts of pollution. There's huge environmental justice issues. I mean, you have people's homes interspersed with, you know, an asphalt plant or auto salvage yards, you know, that all come with lots of discharges and pollution, both into the air and to the water. And so to have a place that is being, that is set aside to be preserved as a wild space that's going to have walking paths, it's a place where the community can go, it's a place where animals can take refuge. So it's really important, it's really exciting, and I've been really impressed with the way the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has been reaching out to the community to see what they're looking for in their community and taking those concerns and those ideas and into account when they're putting the plans, because they're going to do a lot of restoration, a lot of kind of construction, creating wetlands and creating walking paths, and because it was an old dairy, so it's there's a lot of work to be done to restore to better wildlife habitat and a community space.
And it's such an interesting project, because you can't just sort of like let nature take its course. It would take forever, and it wouldn't necessarily work. I mean, this is where, when human beings have degraded land enough, it needs human beings to put it back.
Yeah, I mean, the whole property is very, as I was mentioning, it has drains all through it, and so it's draining parts of the city that naturally it wouldn't have been receiving the water from those parts of the city. And it's been flattened, and, you know, it's very different. It's been very changed from the way the Bosque was, you know, hundreds of years ago. But having said that, we do have this great opportunity with this open piece of land to put in some wetlands, to use some of the water resources that are there to create wetland habitat for wildlife and a refuge for people as well.
We're talking to Rachel Kahn of Amigos Bravos, and so much work. How can people be of help? I mean, you talked about volunteers. What's the next project that you're doing that somebody who might be listening today could get involved with?
Well, we just finished two of our big volunteer efforts. So we just had a Taos community water and land cleanup. And we cleaned up over 20-some tons of trash.
Oh, my goodness.
Is amazing. A lot of those were found in arroyos in some of these ephemeral and intermittent channels that we were talking about earlier. So it was a lot of waste that was picked up.
Where does it go?
Of volunteers. It gets put in dumpsters and goes to the landfill. You mean after we cleaned it up?
Yeah.
And so it gets put into a landfill. Though that's not true about all of it, because we pick up a ton of cans and bottles and plastic. Unfortunately, thousands and thousands of those little shooters, you know, the little shots of alcohol, the little mini bottles.
Minis.
Yes.
Which I think we just outlawed here.
Did we?
In Santa Fe.
Oh, in Santa Fe, yes. No, not in New Mexico as a state, yeah. Yes, that's a great step, because when you get out there and you're cleaning up trash along rivers and along roads and along trails,
you come to hate those things.
Yes. You're like, oh, my back can't take another one of those, reaching down to pick it up. So we recycle those. That's what I was getting at. All the stuff that you can recycle, we do a whole big sorting process where we sort them all out and take them to the recycling center. But a lot of it is non-recyclable trash, and that goes to the landfills.
So, but coming up in the future, or should people just like go to your site and wait around for a while?
Yeah, so we have some opportunities to do water quality sampling. We sample 4 times a year with volunteers in Taos area streams. We have that in addition to the water quality sampling we do down in Albuquerque. So the Albuquerque community can sign up to volunteer to do the sampling in the Valle del Oro. And then we have the Taos County. We have a sampling project that we do, and people can sign up to be volunteers to go out and gather water quality samples through that. We just did that restoration project I was mentioning up at Midnight Meadows, one of our wetland gems. That was a camp out. It's a really fun project. We don't have another one of those scheduled this year right now, though we are looking for people to help inventory some of those head cuts I was mentioning and the stream bank cuts. The impacts that are on the ground, we are hoping to plan later in the year a couple of teams to go up and finish some inventory that we started this past weekend. You need to inventory it so the Forest Service can do the proper planning before you can, you know, put a shovel in the ground or make those zuni bowls I was mentioning. Before you can really disturb anything, you have to get approval through the NEPA, National Environmental Policy Act, process.
Right.
So we have to gather the data to go into that process about which sites need work. So we're looking for people to go out, and that's fun because you're up in these gorgeous meadows and you have a GPS and a little sheet that you're marking what you see and taking photos of these different sites to go into that planning process. So it's like a hike with various stops along the way to gather data.
It's like a kind of, it's almost like citizen science, where citizens who are informed and to some extent trained for what to look for and what tools to use and how to record can really have a big impact.
Yeah, we can have a huge impact. Unfortunately, what we see is a lot of the agencies, the regulatory bodies that are supposed to be doing a lot of this work are underfunded, and they can't go out and collect water quality samples. The state of New Mexico, the Environment Department, only samples rivers once every 7 years.
Oh, my goodness.
So the whole state's divided into these 7 segments, and they only do 1 per summer, or 1 per year. And so that's where our water quality monitoring has come really into play.
Is that under Susana Martinez, or was it always like that?
It was always like that. So it's a resource issue.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, we think, oh, someone's watching out for this. Someone's monitoring this. But really, it's not very often.
7 years is a long time.
A lot can happen in 7 years.
Yeah.
And so our data that we've collected, we've been gathering data since 2007 in 5 Taos County drainages. And that data has actually, we send it to the state, and we have quality assurance protocols in place that the state's approved, so the data is approved. that we send it to the state and they use that in their decision-making processes in terms of listing what waters are polluted for what, which then frees up funding and resources to address those problems. So our data has made a big impact. It's all collected through volunteers. We do trainings for the volunteers, and then we go out and collect samples all around Taos County, as well as down in the Valle del Oro Wildlife Refuge.
It really strikes me when we talk about this whole world of water and wildlife conservation and environment, that there's a kind of David and Goliath thing going on, which is, I mean, you guys do an amazing job. You've been around, as you said, for 27 years. At the same time, it's funded by well-wishers and you know, you're not making a product and selling it. You're protecting people. And on the other side, for the life of me, I just don't understand why it has to be this way, but it seems that industry really doesn't care about clean water, clean drinking water. You'd think they would, but they don't. And so you are continually up against very well-resourced entities.
Yes, I mean, with the it's amazing how many resources some of the parties that we deal with are. You know, that we're a small group, small staff. I mean, we're able to really make a lot with a little. I mean, we do that through working with partners and coalitions of other groups and other community members. And that's been a real core part of Amigos Bravos' work over the years, is bringing together coalitions. So we had the Vividal, the Coalition for the Vividal, which Amigos Bravos was one of the core members and brought that together. And that protected north central New Mexico, beautiful place in the Carson National Forest that was threatened by oil and gas development. And we had a huge campaign where we brought tons of people together, and it was a really big groundswell of public support. And we were able to do that, and we worked with groups that had very different interests. You know, so it wasn't all environmental groups. It was bringing together very different people coming from very different places, but we were able to identify some core values, some core tenets of what our goals were, and just focus on those. You know, all the other groups, they had lots of other things they were working on, which oftentimes we didn't agree with a lot of the other things that other groups, but we were able...
Agricultural stuff? Or?
Well, there was agricultural, yes. Agricultural issues, to large agricultural issues. For the most part, though, a lot of the work that we do is in line with protecting, you know, acequias and small agriculture at Amigos Bravos. The Acequia Association is often one of our partners in a lot of our work. But, you know, it was, you know, large ranching interests. There were kind of more conservative town councils and village councilors, village councils. So it was bringing together government groups and different environmental groups. We had the Republicans for the environment. We had a lot of hunting and angling groups. We had Cattle Growers Association. We had the Philmont Boy Scouts. And so bringing together these different groups of people and identifying our common goal, which was to protect this beautiful place.
That's how you win.
Yeah. Yeah. You get people excited and talking about where they agree and where their passions overlap, and then direct that passion towards protecting a place. And that was very effective in the Coalition for the Valle Vidal, and it's what we've been able to do as well with the Communities for Clean Water, with the work that we're doing in for addressing contamination from Los Alamos National Laboratory. And there we have Tewa Women United, Honor Our Pueblo Existence, both which are Native American women's groups. We have rafting companies, Acequia Association, numerous different groups that have come together to form this coalition. And again, we use the same tool of identifying a value statement that we all share. And that took a long time. Language is important. So yeah. When you're working with different groups that have different ways of thinking about the world, let alone the work, coming to an agreement even on the sentences of our shared value statement, it takes work and time, and that's, you have to have that kind of commitment and acknowledge that building relationships and building a strong coalition takes a lot of work, but it's really worth it. I mean, you get so much strength by a common goal and common vision.
Do you remember what some of the language was in the value statement?
There was talking about protecting water for sacred ceremonies. There was concern. Some of the differences is that not wanting to name the impact, the polluter, that to keep that out of our shared values. Me coming from a more traditional environmental background, I was like, we want to stop the polluter. We want to stop Los Alamos National Lab for polluting our waterways. But there was sentiments from some of our partners that language is very powerful, and we don't want to include the name of the entity that we think is polluting in our shared document, in the document that's describing who we are. So there was different, going through everyone's different perspective and priorities, and it takes time, but you develop wonderful relationships, really strong relationships, and the work is so much stronger because of that.
And that carries over presumably into your next projects.
Yes, yeah. So those relationships we build, we have these built these relationships. We can go and ask for help on our projects, and they can ask for help on theirs, and we can have a louder voice overall.
We're talking about water, and it's so easy to get into this mentality that water is for drinking and irrigating, but water is also habitat.
It's for many things.
And not just for trout that we eat. It's for all these creatures who just live there and have their lives and deserve to have their lives.
Yeah, water, here in the arid Southwest, I mean, our rivers are lifelines. We were talking about ephemeral and intermittent waters earlier, and we have the data that there's over 40% of the mammals in New Mexico are dependent on ephemeral and intermittent waters for to survive.
What are some of those mammals?
So they're large animals, and
like elk,
and yes, and elk for sure, and deer, and a lot of the predators are sometimes these ephemeral and intermittent waters provide the only water source for miles. So you have Playa Lakes out in the southeastern part of the state, and wildlife is critically dependent on those Playa Lakes because it'll be 50 miles before there's another water source. One of the mammals that Amigos Bravos has focused a lot of attention on in our work is the river otter. And through another coalition process, we brought together a group called New Mexico Friends of River Otters, and we worked to restore river otters to New Mexico. They were gone. They were overtrapped, hunted, and disappeared from New Mexico.
I mean, just gone, gone. Weren't any.
There weren't any. Zero. But we had to make sure of that first. That was part of the process. There hadn't been a sighting, confirmed sighting, since 1950. When we started this work in the early, I think we started in 2002 or 2003, we started this work. And there was concern, though, if there were river otters present, that they would be a different kind of river otter than is common throughout the rest of the United States. There was some thought there might be a subspecies here in New Mexico historically, a Sonoran subspecies of river otter. So we certainly didn't want to bring back... We didn't want to reintroduce an otter of a different subspecies if there were the original one here, because they would be genetically swamped. They would, they'd be impacted.
Yeah.
So one of the first steps was to go out, and we monitored and did surveys of all the major river systems in New Mexico to see if we could see any signs of river otters, and we didn't. That took years. Lots of fun, though. It's fun to do river otter surveys. You get out there, you get to go on some beautiful rivers, and it was great. We were also doing habitat surveys at the same time to determine if their habitat existed. If there weren't currently otters, if we brought them back, would they do okay? And after a long process, a lot of work from many individuals and organizations, we were able to restore 33. We reintroduced 33 river otters to the Upper Rio Grande.
Where'd you get them?
We got them from the Northwest, so Washington State.
And so they were basically, if not exactly the same subspecies, they were close enough? kind of thing?
Well, there's questions about whether there was actually a subspecies of otters here, because we never had enough samples to determine that. But all the other otters in the whole United States are all the same species.
Oh, okay.
And so the ones up in Washington State are the same in Colorado, and the same that are in Arizona. And so
you went up to the Pacific Northwest, trapped them, and said, you're moving to your new home.
Yeah, be prepared for a big change.
Oh, my goodness.
So, yes, we flew a couple, and then the rest were driven. They need to stay cool. They can get overheated, and can get agitated by noise. So I always, my vision is there are these two guys as part of the Coalition New Mexico Friends of River Otters that drove up there and got the otters in a very cold, kept the air conditioning on.
They were just like in the
cold,
back seat?
They were in it was in a big van. So, uh-huh. But yeah, they were in the cages in the back, and they kept the air conditioning going and didn't talk the whole way. They just wrote notes to each other to keep it calm for the river otters. And we were able to release them into the Rio Pueblo de Taos, right upstream from the confluence with the Rio Grande. And I was lucky enough to be there on the day of the first release. It was really exciting. We were on a canyon, up on the canyon looking down into the river where they were, the cages, the holding pens. So we got them acclimated and fed them, fattened them up, and kept them there in those pens for a while to get them used to it, to the area, make sure that they had recovered from their cold, silent journey.
Yeah, yeah.
and so when the day came, we opened the doors to the cages, and we were watching from up above real quietly, and it took a while for them to crawl out, and they peek their head, and then they crawl back in. They peek their head out crawl back in, and they weren't so sure about coming out, but finally, you know, they started coming out of the cages, and the light was just right that from up on the canyon, top of the canyon, you could look down and you could see through the water. And, you know, I must have had my glasses, you know, the UV, the polarized glasses, where you could see through the water. And so you could see them darting, swimming underneath the water from up above, chasing this school of fish. I'll never forget that, watching. They're such swift swimmers. So they were darting under the water, chasing. Yeah. The fish were kind of scattering. It was a beautiful vision. And
they're thriving now.
A couple have been killed. But we have had lots of sightings reported all up and down the Rio Grande, and we're hoping that there's going to be confirmed sightings of reproduction.
Rachel Kahn is Interim Executive Director of Amigos Bravos, which is on the web at amigosbravos.org. And once again, tomorrow, Thursday, the 25th of June, is the big event, River Radio Days. It's from 8 in the morning until 6 in the evening, and you and many others will be there talking about what's going on at Amigos Bravos, and there's a raffle for three items: a trip to the Sacred Valley of the Incas in Peru, a cash prize, or an acre of land. For more information and to buy tickets, you can go to amigosbravos.org. And you can also go to Sid's Food Market and Kate House. You can also call 575-758-3874. And you don't have to be at the event to buy a ticket. You can buy tickets online.
No, you do not have to be present to win. And we encourage people to go online or to call our office, 575-758-3874, or amigosbravos.org. And if you are not a member and you buy a ticket, then you get a year's membership with your raffle ticket purchase.
Excellent. Rachel, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.